Accession number 8941, rule number 6.
Major Jeffson, rule 6. I think you were saying that some people had vanished when you'd arrived.
I did, yes. And I'd like to talk about the people who vanished, but I ended the last reel with two perhaps rather injudicious words, and I'd be glad if you'd take them out of that reel and put them into a little better context on this reel, yeah? Because I think I used the words officers' mutiny in 11th HAC, and that is slightly exaggerating things. But it is clear that when the 11th HAC broke out of Matru and came to join us, they were under command of Major Jeff... Oh dear, I've used his name a few minutes ago. Jeff... I'll supply his name later. And he brought them to join us. And their own CO was not there, and the padre went off and pulled him out of the Hotel Cecil. And it is equally true that after the action, he resumed command of the regiment, and that those who were there, the officers who were there on the 2nd of July, several of them refused to serve under him, and that they left the regiment, he didn't. In other words, I suspect that he had a very good reason for being away, which was not known to them. Yeah. Certainly, Inglis, the New Zealander, was a very highly respected senior officer, and he wasn't there. And there are one or two others whose movements are difficult to trace in those few hours. And I believe that when the truth is known, we shall find that there were a nucleus of highly placed and well-respected men. Whether these were amongst them or not, I don't know, but a nucleus who had been called back to receive secret orders. I think that is quite likely. It seems to fit other inferences you can draw from things. Yeah? But I don't know. But I do know that Leggett wasn't there. I do know that Jeff Armstrong, who was the chap who did very well with us, fell out with him as a result of it. However, that's by the way. How do we approach that particular point, danger point?
Well, I was asking you what had been done with you once you got beyond the wire at Alamein, and I think you've been saying that people were sitting around waiting.
Elamayid station at 0700 hours on the 1st of July. Yes. That is a known fact, because I've been privileged to read several diaries in which all these facts, including the fact that they were discussing John McCarthy, who now lives with his mother in Godalming, are all recorded. And eventually, Rob Waller received orders from 50 Div. Whether he actually got it from Crasher Nichols or from Douglas Brown, I'm not 100% certain, but the orders he received came from 50 Div, and they were to collect up any guns and infantry he could find and form at least a column. The indications are that his actual orders were to form two columns, but he only managed to form one. You will find in many maps of the area the fact that there are supposed to be three 50-div columns there on the 2nd of July. There weren't. He had formed one and had received orders to form two. There is a third column called ACCOL, which is 3RHA, who were further back and actually don't, I'm absolutely certain, didn't arrive on the 2nd of July, but the 3rd of July. But Rob Waller got these orders to form two columns, and in fact he formed one consisting of the 11th Field, which, as I said, had already lost one troop of 25-pounders and one troop of 2-pounders, But while we were waiting at El Alamein on the night of the 30th of June, the adjutant had been fairly vigorous, and he had gone off, and he'd actually, no, he'd sent someone off who had got from one of the base depots, I think it was six, I just have to check the exact figure if you ever wanted to use this, and I think it was six pounders, which in fact were destined for the New Zealand division, but came to us.
They were just called out to the depot then?
Yeah, they were drawn out to the depot under protest, and probably at rifle point. That was the way things were going at that time. But eventually, we had a few six-pounders. Don't forget, we had this troop of 265 and a tank, this battery of 265 and a tank, less one troop that they'd lost, and a chap called Meredith Budd, who was a subaltern in 265, found himself, while this meeting was going on at Elimayed Station, he found himself being called by Major Paul, and Major Paul said to him, you recognise these? These are six-pounders. Now, you've actually handled one, so you're in charge of this troop. Old Meredith spent the rest of that morning working out the gun drill on a six-pounder, never having actually commanded a six-pounder in his life before. And he now had a troop of six, I think it was. And equally, we had drawn in, because E troop was down to one gun of the original four. We got in the course of the night of the 30th, the day of the 1st, and early morning of the 2nd, one gun, certainly, of 32nd Field, under command of a Sergeant Franklin. One gun from another source, which I'm still trying to trace, but I think it was probably a gun from 121 Field, who, while this was going on, were being beaten up in the Deir el-Shine. Yeah? And certainly two guns which owed their loyalty to 164 Field, but which had originally come from 157 Field, because 164 Field had only been in existence for a few hours before it was wiped out.
How did you get these? Were they just grabbed off the line of march? Or?
Well, they were, as the troops retreated to El Alamein, there were four MP staging posts where people were sorted out. There was one on the Alamein Road that we had come through. There was one by the Deir el-Shine that the Essex actually came through, the colonel of the Essex came through. There was one down towards Himaimut. And one, I think the other one was El Nail. I've got the map references of them, but they're well established, and there were these four, and they were actually on the track, the not the Trigger Labbed, the White Mosque of Sidi. Oh, there's a track just in front of the Alamein position called the Sidi Abdul Rahman track, that's right. The Sidi Abdul Rahman track. They were all on that track, just on the western side of the of what became the Alamein line. And so by now, E Troop was up to four guns. The fifth gun actually arrived, I believe. His testimony encouraged me to believe it. Actually, as we were moving off on the morning of the 2nd of July. But we moved off ourselves midday the 1st of July and moved on to the eastern end of the Rowaisa Ridge by the Orkin Lakes headquarters, where Corps headquarters also was, right on the very high ground, 0.101 and 0.97 at the eastern end of the ridge. And we put up an OP. I don't think we actually went into firing positions, but we put out an OP that night, and he reported the collapse of the Deir el-Shine, and the troops from the Deir el-Shine started to come through us during that night. There's no doubt about it that the 18th Indian Brigade and 97th Field and 121 Field, with their few surviving guns, bought time that was absolutely invaluable and has never been fully appreciated, although there are one or two quite good accounts of their battle. Anyway, next morning, the 2nd of July, we marched off. Now, we marched off now in the desert formation I've tried to describe, with a line of armoured OPs in front and the guns following their leader in four battery lines, and the anti-tank guns and the AK-AK guns behind, and odds and sods like me further back. And
how wide a front would you be then as a regiment in desert formation, and how
I have tried to think it out. It must be something like 2,000 yards, I would think. Because, let's see, you've got four troops of 25-pounders. Each of those has an armoured car. You've got a troop of... You've got three troops of 2-pounders and 6-pounders. They, I think, would only have one armoured car between them. There's a second-in-command's armoured car, the CO's armoured car, and probably the brigadier's armoured car. So you've got a line, I would think, of something like 8 or 10 armoured cars in front.
Abreast.
And we almost certainly had one or two armoured cars in their own right with us, probably the scouts. So I would think that we've got at least 10 trucks abreast that way. And they should be at about 150 yards apart anyway, so you've got something like a mile, 2,000 yards front that you're covering. Whether that's maintained or not is another matter, but that's the sort of the area we're talking
about.
Yes, and we're marching, don't forget, in fact, along the southern flank of a low escarpment. It 0.63, 0.6. Well, we come down from 0.97 to 0.63, 0.63, 0.63, and then a hell of a drop into the Darro Shine. And on the other side, it goes down to 30s very quickly, and then onto the sea. And this side down to 30s. So you've got something like 30 metres up and down. And we were marching on the southern flank, though I think we had an observer on the actual ridge. In fact, I'm pretty well certain we did, because eventually he looked into the narrow shine. And we marched along, and I was still bringing up Backstop Charlie. And although I was command post officer, I wasn't thinking of command post work at all. I was thinking of, hell, when do we meet the 21st Armoured Division, you know? And then suddenly someone goes bang up there in the sky, and a rather nasty crack of an airburst. And up in front of me, and they were probably themselves 2 or 3 miles in front of me at this moment, the OPs give the order to get into action.
What sort of armoured cars were the OPs in?
That time I was in the 1500. Like me later. Armoured cars in the 11th Field were what are called patternuggers. And they were they were a beautiful truck, actually. One of the best things that came out of India. They were a bit that shaped.
So the rhomboid in shape.
Yes. And they were just Indian steel with quite a good engine inside at the back. And a whole hole in the roof, and the room for four or five of you. The wireless would be here on one side, and the driver there on the other, and me sticking up there, and there was somewhere I could stand here if I wanted to. The Tatanaga was a good armoured car. We all liked it very much. And as I said, the regiment had about 10 at that time.
But no armament on it?
We had a Bren gun here, I think. Yes.
But that would be a purely defensive
gun. Purely AK-AK defensive gun, really. Though, yes, there was also a mounting for it here, and indeed later on in the war I did once fire it forward. But it wasn't meant for annoying people. It was they're purely defensive, really.
How deep would this column be? Describe the width of it.
Well, if it was 1 mile to 2,000 yards wide, it was probably up to 8 to 10,000 yards deep, because you get laggards and people have difficulty with going over sand or rocks or. And certainly, I would think that I was 8 to 10,000 yards behind the leaders when the blue went up.
What sort of speed were you? Would you go in that sort of formation if you wanted to try and keep it reasonably correct, maintain station?
I don't think I'd wish to be quoted on that in the military circles. We could get a reasonable lick up, but so much depends upon the surface of the desert and the job one was trying to do. I would think at that time we were probably doing something between 10 and 15 miles an hour, something like that, but don't regard that as a fact. That's merely my estimation.
When you were actually formed up in such a formation or on the move, was there any means of maintaining communication?
Yes. We were practicing wireless silence as we marched off. We all had blue flags on our starboard bow for identification purposes. And the CO could do things like that. The troop commander could rush back and shout to his GPO if he wanted to. And again, I don't think any of us ever felt the fact that we were cut off in any way, because we were so used to doing this. When you say communication, I don't suppose, in fact, while we were actually moving, there was any formal way of communicating, not while we were observing wireless silence.
You mentioned your chaps being up on the ridge and the ridge being quite high. How far could you actually see from the ridge?
Well, you can see that from that map. And there is 0.63, and it drops down to the sea. So you can imagine that from that map that there is the ridge, and you can see that 63 at the end. There's the narrow shine that goes way down. Now, those very quickly dropped to 28, 30, 40, and down there there's a slight escarpment before the sea. You can see as far as the dust and the heat haze will let you.
And what about looking directly westwards?
Directly westwards.
Could you see very long distances that way?
Well, south, you see, you've got a ridge here that... you've got this, what was known as Stuka Valley later. Then the ridge, 3,000-4,000 yards to the south of the ridge, there's another ridge that's in the 70s. It's climbing slowly towards the depression. You could see Himaimut from my OPs up here later. You could see the pimple of Himaimut, which is way down here. But that was Himaimut has a very distinctive tall pimple. The difficulty is recognising things, because you can see a tar barrel at 1,000 paces that could in fact be an enormous thing at 10,000 paces. And you've very little way of sorting out tell from which.
Because of the distortion.
You see different things at different times of day. I mean, the mirage in the sometimes in midday. You were saying you'd be to Marrakesh, weren't you? When you get the same mirage in the Shotel, whatever it is, just as you're coming into Tunisia. I looked from here, for instance, later on the 20, after the beginning of Fourth Alamein, and I looked over there. My pimple was here. That's me. That beer, where I had an OP tower that was 40 foot high, and most people in the British Army could see me actually because that bit on me. Most people in the German Army too, but only that bit on me. And I looked out there, and I reported seeing, I forget what the exact division was, on their objective. And nearly had Montgomery on the phone, because they weren't on their objective. But when I was looking at what I could see movement there, and it looked like tanks.
How far away was that?
Well, that'd be 7,000 or 8,000 yards. But I misreported. But I thought I could see.
You mentioned moving through mist on your...
Well, the morning of the 29th yes. or 30th is reported in most of these histories as the morning of mist of the desert.
Did you have a lot of mist? Another obscuration?
It was sufficiently strong and significant for it to be mentioned in umpteen regimental histories. At the same time, it wasn't altogether unknown. And, of course, one occasionally had, in fact, on that map, if you look at it, it says impassable when wet, which is something you don't expect to see in a desert map. I think somewhere down here. Pool after rain, that's right. Bullet El Torch in the El Maria. Pool after rain, which is not something you think of in the desert.
What was this ridge like geologically? Was it just a ridge?
It was just bloody hard rock, and you couldn't dig in it. And this was one of our major problems. But we did build sangers. There was a certain amount of sand about, but it was basically very, very hard rock, granite type.
What about the surface underneath, below the ridge?
Below the ridge, there was some sand, but again, it was blown off. There were patches of sand where you might get bogged down and need sand mat to get out. But that particular area is more hard rock than anything.
And is it just a flat surface, or is it pebbles, or what is it?
It's a bit like I imagine the moon looks, pebbly. In one sense, it's a remarkably flat area, but in another, it's got its little contours and rocks and tar barrels and occasional patches of camel thorn. And occasional patches of sand.
And on this ridge, what sort of shape is it? Is it a roughly triangular ridge? Does it have a flat top to it? Is it terraced or is it sloping? The Ruaisa
Ridge. My memory of it, as I was on it for 4 months, is basically a pyramid shape. But I don't remember it in its beam ends so much as in its keel, where you had very clearly 0.63, 0.63 and 0.63, and 1.63, the eastern 0.63, was in our hands from the 2nd of July onwards. Western 0.63 was in German hands, except for a few hours until after the 2nd of November, and middle 0.63 was what we were fighting over. And across it came this track, which is an offshoot of the Sidi Abdul Rahman track. Now, from that came this track, which crossed over on 0.63, where my OP tower was, and it must be that 0.42 or no, that one, that one there.
34.
Yeah, that in fact was a beer, and could be full of water. I never saw it full of water, but it obviously had been full of water at some stage.
So if I get the picture, you were rolling along, and you were right at the back.
Right at the back, yeah.
And there were airbursts.
There was an airburst.
Yes. And what happened then once the shooting?
Well, what happened up front, of course, I can only describe in other people's words.
But what happened at your end?
At my end, I just kept on going and gradually caught up with them. And by then, the two batteries were in action. And as I say, one troop particularly, the two troops were in action, the two batteries were in action. And I joined up with my battery in the middle. And I found the VC. And he said, presumably, don't remember his exact words, but as a result of meeting him, I set up a command post. At least I tried to start digging down this wretched rock.
Actually, on the ridge.
South of the ridge. South of the ridge. Not all that far from the ridge. I say we were opening up at 2,000. The lead troop opened up at 2,900 to people on the westward 0.63.
So they were approaching from the west southwest.
As they came along this ridge, the Africa Corps poked their heads up the other side. As you can imagine, I'm somewhere about here, maybe.
Yes.
The regiment spread out along there. In fact, that's where they got to that day. That's Rob Cole, 2nd of July. Here's the Germans. They're in the Darolshan. They've been there overnight. They almost certainly had someone up here by early morning who watched us come along. But as we came along here, they first came around here. And some people, there were OP's trucks up there. And the two 83-85 battery was on the right, closest to the ridge. And we took on Don Troop, under Captain Clements, took on a motor brigade. Chaps in motorised infantry. And he had quite a good shoot against him in the morning.
Who else was in Rob Cole at that time, besides the guns?
At that time, there was one company of the 1st Force Essex. There was the 1st Force Essex carrier platoon, either with us or approaching us. There was the 1st Force Essex anti-tank platoon, either with us or approaching us. And to the best of my knowledge and belief, no one else.
What did the infantry do then?
One omission. We had with us some anti-aircraft guns, four, I think, from either 133 AKEK or 155 AKEK.
What were they equipped with? Were they with the Bofors?
They were Bofors, yes, simple Bofors.
What did the infantry do then during this initial engagement in the first stages of the... Were they up with the guns at the front of the column?
Because I was behind, I didn't see what went on. But I would be most surprised if they didn't, in fact, travel behind the guns in the column. And when the guns went into action, I know that fairly quickly they took up positions round the gun position. And indeed, I have testimony from people on the guns who saw infantry in front of them.